Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We are going to start in the royal section. Then we're going to move to Hollywood. We've got some current events there. And then we'll move over to the politics section. We are, like I said, starting in the royal section, and the first article, Prince William and Princess Kate played a crucial role in a decision to strip Andrew of title, says source. The Prince of Wales is said to be thrilled with the response to his 5-day trip to Brazil as it shifted the spotlight away from his scandal-plagued uncle, sources tell Vanity Fair. This is by Katie Nichol on November 7th. This week, Prince William redirected the media's focus from the scandal surrounding his uncle, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, to his environmental conservation efforts with a trip to Brazil in support of the Earthshot Prize. The Prince of Wales will head back to the UK on Friday after a 5-day tour of Brazil, which included a starry Earthshot Prize award ceremony on Wednesday in Rio de Janeiro, with performances by Kylie Minogue and Shawn Mendes, and a video message from Tom Cruise. On Thursday, William represented King Charles at COP30 Climate Summit in Belém, Brazil. William is said to be thrilled with the success of his trip and even more delighted that Andrew is no longer dominating headlines. According to sources close to the prince, William has been acutely aware of the damage his uncle is causing the monarchy and is determined to do what he can to preserve its reputation. William believes passionately in the future of the monarchy, and he knows that it is at a crucial point, says a royal insider. He was very involved in the decision to have Andrew formally stripped of his titles. While the king has taken credit, William and his wife actually have played a crucial role behind the scenes. On October 30th, Buckingham Palace released an official statement announcing the decision to officially strip Andrew of his titles. His Majesty has today initiated a formal process to remove the style, titles, and honors of Prince Andrew, it read. His lease on Royal Lodge has to date provided him with legal protection to continue in residence. Formal notice has now been served to surrender the lease, and he will move to alternate private accommodation. According to one family friend, the couple lobbied hard for Andrew to move out of Royal Lodge, his home for more than 20 years, located on the Windsor estate. He will now live on the more remote and privately owned Sandringham estate. Meanwhile, Prince William and Kate Middleton recently moved into Forest Lodge in Windsor, where they're expected to live when they become king and queen. William was the hand on his father's back. He has been instrumental in the whole thing. Kate has been very firm, too. They both made it clear that Andrew cannot be anywhere near them in Windsor, said a family friend. Some view King Charles's unprecedented decision to formally remove Andrew's titles as a warning to Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. There's a clear message from the very top, says a source close to the royals. William is ruthless when it comes to the monarchy and protecting its reputation. If anyone, and that includes the Sussexes, is seen to be damaging the reputation of the monarchy, there will be serious repercussions. Harry wants to come back to Britain more. Charles has opened the door, but William is more cautious. He's tough and resolute and very protective of his family, and he will allow no one to damage it. According to another source, William spent time with his father in Scotland last month discussing how to deal with what is apparently known as the Andrew problem. The king doesn't like confrontation and had concerns about cutting Andrew out completely. He's worried about Andrew being a loose cannon. William has been much firmer from the outset. He has no sentimental attachment to Andrew. He thinks he is toxic and wants him as far away as possible. They both agreed the family needed to distance itself from Andrew and robust action needed to happen. On that, they were absolutely aligned. In recent weeks, leaked emails emerged showing that Andrew continued to keep in touch with convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein for some time after he claimed he cut off contact in a 2019 Newsnight interview with journalist Emily Maitlis. Soon after, Andrew's princely status and royal orders were revoked. This week, King Charles issued a letter patent to formally and legally remove Andrew of his HRA titles and that of Prince. And the other royals, Prince Harry apologizes to Canada for the World Series Hatgate. I was under duress. Canadians jokingly accused Prince Harry of betrayal after he was spotted wearing a Dodgers cap at the World Series. This is by Seraphine Roger on November 7th. Prince Harry, accompanied by Meghan Markle, came for a baseball game and left with a new controversy. On October 28th, the Sussexes attended the fourth game of the World Series between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Toronto Blue Jays. The couple sat in the front row behind the dugout, all smiles with Los Angeles team caps on their head, cheering for their adopted home team. But Prince Harry made the mistake of wearing a Dodgers cap. As soon as he was spotted wearing the bright blue accessory, some Canadians accused him of betraying his heritage. Canada is a Commonwealth country whose head of state is King Charles III. Arriving in Canada on Wednesday for a two-day visit to commemorate Remembrance Day, celebrated on November 11th, Prince Harry was naturally asked about what has jokingly been deemed Hatgate. Is there anything you'd like to say about wearing that Los Angeles Dodgers cap last week and getting in hot water? He was asked by CTV News on Thursday. Oh, the Los Angeles Dodgers cap. Well, firstly, I'd like to apologize to Canada for wearing it, he explained. Secondly, I was under duress. There wasn't much choice, he added with a smile. Invited to the game by the Dodgers owner, he thought it was polite to do so. Prince Harry confided that there was an additional reason for his choice of headgear. When you're missing a lot of hair on top and you're sitting under floodlights, you'll take any hat that's available, he joked. During the interview, the 41-year-old Brit grabbed a Blue Jays cap, which had been given to him earlier in the day, and popped it onto his head, saying he would wear it from now on to make sure I don't make any more of those mistakes. At the same time, he assured those gathered he had remained a loyal supporter of the Canadian team throughout the championship, despite his adopted hometown and choice of accessories. Now that I've admitted it, it's going to be really hard for me to return to Los Angeles, he added. Meghan Markle also supported her hometown team, the Dodgers, in the World Series, even though she lived in Toronto for 7 years for filming of the series Suits. The American player's dramatic Game 7 victory delighted the Duchess of Sussex, if a jubilant video she shared on her Instagram story at the time is anything to go by. Prince Harry, perhaps, had a harder time digesting the Blue Jays' defeat. This next article is going to segue us into the celebrity news. David Beckham is officially a knight, and Victoria has a new royal honor too. The legendary soccer player was knighted by King Charles III Tuesday in a ceremony in Windsor. This is by Margot Blaise on November 5th. At Windsor Castle on Tuesday, David Beckham was knighted by King Charles III for services to sport and charity. As announced last June, the former England captain, now 50, received a knighthood for his career. The soccer star was deeply moved by the ceremony, which he declared his proudest moment in a lengthy Instagram caption, which he also expanded on in an interview with the Associated Press after the ceremony. Being an East London boy, growing up in Leytonstone, moving to Manchester, and now stood here with His Majesty the King, giving me a knighthood is something I could never have imagined happening to me, he said. I've been lucky in my career to have won what I've won and done what I've done, but to receive an honor like this of a knight is beyond anything that I ever thought that I would receive. A true global icon, he has established himself as one of the greatest footballers of his generation, playing for some of the most prestigious clubs, such as Real Madrid and Manchester. In addition to his storied career, Beckham supports a number of charities. Since 2005, he has been a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF. Of course, the athlete is also known for his refined sense of style. He came dressed in a gray suit, custom made by his wife, former pop star turned fashion designer, Victoria Beckham. David said that his look was inspired by the king's style and that the monarch was quite impressed with his suit. He's kind of the most elegantly dressed man that I know, so he inspired quite a few of my looks over the years, and he definitely inspired this look, the newly minted knight told Wire Services. It was something that my wife made me. I looked at old pictures of him when he was quite young in morning suits, and I was like, okay, that's what I want to wear. So I gave it to my wife, and she did it. In a celebratory Instagram post, proud wife Victoria also noted that the suit was the first ever tailored menswear piece from the Victoria Beckham Atelier. She too received an honor alongside her husband's knighthood, a title. She's now officially Lady Victoria. At the time of the announcement of his ennoblement last June, Victoria shared on social networks how proud she was to see her husband decorated with the title. You've always been my knight in shining armor, but now it's official, she enthused. Sir David Beckham, what an honor. I couldn't be prouder of you, she wrote. Your dedication to the things that matter most, your country, your work, your passion, and most of all, your family has never wavered. The way you've touched so many lives over the years with kindness and humility speaks volumes about the man you are and continues to inspire us every day. But above all else, I'm so, so proud to call you mine. I love you so much. Moving into the Hollywood and celebrity category, at the Soho Sessions celebration of Bruce Willis, musicians went the whole nine yards. Willis himself couldn't attend the event, but Keith Richards, Demi Moore, Michael J. Fox, and Emma Heming Willis were all there for the concert, a benefit for the Association for Frontotemporal Degeneration. This is by Bria Cubitt on November 6th. In a softly lit loft nestled within a commercial building in Soho, portraits of iconic musicians line the walls in asymmetric clusters. The collection, provided by the Morrison Hotel Gallery, includes one image in particular that catches the eye. Bruce Willis grinning beside the late Dr. John at the Beacon Theater in 2017. The photo helps set the mood for Wednesday night's intimate invite-only event, a benefit concert celebrating Willis and raising funds for the Association for Frontotemporal Degeneration, or AFTD, which supports research and families affected by the rare brain disorder Willis was diagnosed with in 2023. Five musical acts took stage: the venue's house band, Nora Jones, Mavis Staples, Keith Richards, and Warren Haynes, uniting some of music's most legendary voices. Willis's ex-wife, Demi Moore, was there, as were Michael J. Fox and Tracy Pollan, among others. This evening, presented by the Soho Session co-founders Gregory Williamson and Nicole Rector, unfolded in a space interior designer Tawanda Schlegel said she had curated to capture the ethos of live music and community. That intention translated into every detail. Three tucked-away bars glowed softly in different sections of the loft, enticing attendees to grab a drink and mingle. Rows of plush green velvet couches lined the front of the stage where VIP guests, such as Whoopi Goldberg, sat comfortably. Willis's wife, Emma Heming Willis, took the stage first to share a few opening remarks. "I honestly wish Bruce could be here, but he is here in spirit," she said. She recalled when the organizers first approached her about hosting the event, "I was like, fuck yeah, can we please have some fun?" The performances lived up to that sentiment. After the house band kicked things off with a harmonica-heavy groove, Jones stepped out to perform "The Long Way Home" and "Come Away With Me," filling the room with her soft, soothing vocals. Afterwards, Staples made an upbeat entrance, walking out with a radiant smile and a rhythmic clap reminiscent of a Baptist church. She belted "City in the Sky" before calling Jones back up for a duet of "You Are Not Alone," a gorgeous rendition they sang while holding hands. Staples ended her set with her 1972 hit, "I'll Take You There," urging the crowd into a call and response to help deliver the titular refrain before finishing on a standing ovation. The night carried on with Richards. "At least you don't have to follow Mavis Staples," he joked to the crowd, who performed a bluesy rock set tearing through classics "Key to the Highway" and "You Got the Silver." He then delivered an early Christmas present, breaking into Chuck Berry's "Run, Rudolph, Run," which featured a spectacular piano solo from renowned instrumentalist Ivan Neville. Rounding out the evening, Haynes performed a soulful 7.5-minute rendition of "The Thrill Is Gone" before closing with "Soulshine" and "Statesboro Blues." His electrifying guitar solos pierced the room, prompting one attendee in a Metallica jacket to fist pump while others cheered. Goldberg, who danced and swayed through each set, spoke to Vanity Fair after the show, saying, "I'm sad that this cause exists, but if we're gonna fight it, this is the best way I can think of." She also reflected on her longtime rapport with Willis. "We've been friends for 30 years, I think, so anything I can do for him and the family, I'm happy to do it." For Williamson, that spirit of solidarity has defined the Soho Sessions. "There's nothing really like it because of the intimacy, the caliber of the artists," he told Vanity Fair. "Everybody's in it for the community, for the cause. You just have this room where the artist and the audience are of equal measure, and it all comes together in such a beautiful way," he summed up the night. The whole purpose was to bring people together and shine a light on the cause. Bruce always wanted people to have a good time. as guests lingered near the velvet couches after the event, laughing and chatting over a playlist of rock and soul tracks, it was hard not to feel the spirit of Willis's famous quote, "Live it up." Our next headline, Millie Bobby Brown reportedly filed a harassment and bullying claim against David Harbour. According to the Daily Mail, the 21-year-old allegedly filed the complaint against Harbour before filming on the fifth and final season of Stranger Things began last year. This is by Roberta Mercury on November 3rd. All is allegedly not well in Hawkins, Indiana. According to the Daily Mail, Millie Bobby Brown reportedly filed a lengthy complaint about David Harbour before they began filming the final season of Stranger Things. A source told the outlet that Brown, who plays psychic test subject 11 on the hit Netflix series, filed a harassment and bullying claim against Harbour, who plays 11's adoptive father, ex-police chief Jim Hopper, before season 5 began shooting in January of last year. "There were pages and pages of accusations," the source told the Daily Mail. The investigation went on for months. The outcome of the investigation and the details surrounding the claims are currently unknown. According to the Daily Mail, Brown's allegations against Harbour did not include claims of sexual impropriety. Brown was reportedly accompanied by a personal legal representative on set at all times while filming the show's final season. Harbour's Jim Hopper adopts Brown's 11, and their rocky father-daughter relationship is a central theme of the show, which means they share significant screen time. This is not the first time such allegations have plagued the Stranger Things set. A grip claimed in 2018 that two members of the Stranger Things team were creating a toxic work environment, with some believing that series creator Matt and Ross Duffer, aka the Duffer Brothers, were responsible. According to CBS News, Netflix conducted an investigation and found no wrongdoing. Outside of Stranger Things drama, Harbour is in the midst of a public split from singer-songwriter Lily Allen. Allen recently dropped her first album in 7 years, West End Girl, inspired by their messy separation. On the album, Allen graphically details alleged intimate aspects of their relationship, including various alleged betrayals committed by Harbour. Per the Daily Mail source, the Stranger Things workplace complaints were completely unrelated to Allen's grievances with Harbour. "Lily supported him through it all," the Mail source said. "It was a brutal time." The 21-year-old Brown recently married actor Jake Bon Jovi, son of rocker John Bon Jovi, and adopted a baby girl. Stranger Things' final season will be released in 3 parts, with the first 4 episodes dropping on Netflix on November 26th. 3 more episodes will debut on Christmas, with a 2-hour finale episode released in select cinemas and on Netflix on New Year's Eve. Vanity Fair has reached out to Brown, Harbour, and Netflix for comment. Next up in the Hollywood section, Kristen Stewart lets loose in a fiery speech. Hollywood is in a state of emergency. As the keynote speaker at the Academy Women's Lunches, the actor-director didn't hold back her frustration. "It's like we're not even supposed to be angry, but I could eat this podium with a fork and fucking knife. I'm so angry." This is by Rebecca Ford on November 4th. The Academy Women's Luncheon is a lovely, warm annual celebration of women in the industry that gathers many of Hollywood's most influential people on the picturesque rooftop of the Academy Museum. "Wait, this is all women? So sick!" Marty Supreme star Odessa Azian exclaimed when she entered the space on November 4th. "It is sick. A gathering of women excited to raise each other up over a chic lunch, capped with a motivational speech from a notable actor. Usually the keynote speaker is polite and uplifting, but at this year's event, Kristen Stewart had other plans. "We can be stoked today if we point out the elephant in the room. There are too few of us," she said. Stewart opened her speech by talking about her directorial debut, The Chronology of Water, before turning to her main message, the extreme gender inequality that still plagues Hollywood. "It's like we're not even supposed to be angry, but I can eat this podium with a fork and fucking knife. I'm so angry," she said. Stewart was poised and passionate as she pointed out how few women still get opportunities to direct major releases. According to the most recent study from San Diego State University, women accounted for just 16% of directors working on the 250 highest-grossing domestic releases of 2024 and only 11% of the 100 most popular films, a drop of 3 percentage points from 2023. May I leave my contortionist skills at the door and speak from the heart? May I not conceal or reframe my anger, but share it so as to move through it to something more fun and more beautiful and less boring and more original, she told the crowd. Our business is in a state of emergency, man, and the last thing that I want to do here is lose the celebration under a pile of pissed off rubble. The crowd at the event, presented by Chanel, listened closely. A group that included Tessa Thompson, Zoe Deutsch, Kate Hudson, Sarah Paulson, Felicity Jones, Caitlin Dever, Claire Foy, Riley Keough, Carrie Condone, Alicia Silverstone, Emma Macri, and Leslie Mann, with her daughter Maude Apatow. Before Stewart's keynote address, the attendees were welcomed to their seats by Academy President Lynette Howell Taylor, who took over the leadership post only this past July. The event was also a congratulatory moment for emerging filmmakers Alina Simone and Marlene Vignaio, who will receive mentorship and support as this year's recipients of the Academy Gold Fellowship for Women. As Stewart's speech pointed out, female filmmakers do not face an easy road. We are allowed to be proud of ourselves, she said at the podium. I'm thankful to you. I'm not grateful to a boys' club business model that pretends to want to hang out with us while siphoning our resources and belittling our truth. In the end, Stewart was able to balance the celebratory tone of the event with a call to action aimed at those in the room. What feels obvious to me is that pretending it isn't happening is not an option, she said. Those of us who have been lucky enough to make a movie have a responsibility to those who are yet to come. And in international relations, Angelina Jolie visits Ukraine for the second time since the start of the war. The American actor visited Kherson to meet with children and staff at medical facilities, including a maternity ward and a children's hospital. This is by Blanche Marcel on November 7th. More than 3 years after the start of the war, Angelina Jolie is back in Ukraine. The Oscar-winning actor and director went to Kherson on the south of the country to visit a maternity hospital and children's hospital, once again demonstrating her humanitarian commitment. In April 2022, Jolie had already visited Lviv, in the west of the country, to meet people displaced by the war. On Wednesday, Jolie, who was a United Nations Special Envoy for Refugees between 2012 and 2022, renewed her commitment to the cause. On social media, local official Vitaly Bogdanova shared photos of the star wearing a bulletproof vest emblazoned with the logo of the Legacy of War Foundation, an organization helping civilians affected by the conflict. Jolie arrived in Ukraine as part of a humanitarian aid program and has visited a number of medical facilities in the region, including a maternity hospital and a children's hospital, reported the Kyiv Post, citing local media and Telegram channels. According to Politico, a senior official said that Jolie had not informed the Ukrainian government of her visit and entered the country on foot. The official told Politico that a member of Jolie's team had an incident at a checkpoint with a local military recruiters. The Ukrainian ground forces released a statement saying that Jolie's driver had been detained at a checkpoint and was in the process of being drafted into the army, but later deleted it and told Politico they could neither confirm nor deny details of what happened. The visit comes a week after Volodymyr Zelensky denounced a deliberate Russian attack on a children's hospital in Kherson, which injured 9 people, including 4 children. From the style category, all aboard the SS Carbone. Inside Mario Carbone & Co.'s Carbone Riviera in Las Vegas, which campily comes with its own 33-foot mini yacht. This is by Elise Taylor. I'm going to get straight to the point. Carbone has a mini yacht. Its name is Fortuna. Its port of origin is the Bellagio Fountain in Las Vegas, whose 8.5-acre chlorined waters reach 13 feet at their deepest point. A captain named Mike technically could floor it, but he's not gonna, because it would make you spill your glass of champagne or your potato chip loaded with Petrosian caviar. There's also olives and Bloody Mary spiced cashews, but that feels less like precious culinary cargo in the grand scheme of things, and the schemes are indeed grand. The Fortuna sails for 45 minutes to an hour as the fountains Bellagio erupt behind you in a choreographed sky-high water dance to a soundtrack of your choice, which can be anything from Bruno Mars' Uptown Funk to Frank Sinatra's Luck Be a Lady to Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On. Is the latter an odd choice for a boat ride? Yes. Did I still make it? Also yes. The boat is invite only. I was invited because I was writing about it, but in general, you need to be some sort of celebrity, influencer, a Bellagio VIP, or an FOMC, friend of Mario Carbone. The kitchen can whip you up a bunch of different things, but they suggest champagne and caviar because the yacht experience is best before dinner or after dinner, and that dinner will be presumably at the soon-to-open Carbone Riviera. Carbone Riviera isn't your typical Carbone. It's not dark and clubby, but rather maximalist and airy. Blue and gold stone mosaics adorn pillars, and a ceiling is painted with tan and taupe swirls. The interior designer is Martin Brudzinski, who designed Annabelle's in London, as well as Fouquet's in New York City. In the center of the room sits a cornucopic arrangement of roses, oranges, and artichokes. A cherub holds up a bowl of lemons. On the walls hang Miros, Renoir, and Picasso. About that Picasso, it's from the restaurant that used to be here, which used the artist as its namesake. Picasso was a legendary fine dining staple on the Strip for 26 years before it closed in 2024. After the chef, Julian Serrano, retired, MGM Resorts, which owns the Bellagio, knew it had tough kitchen whites to fill. Enter Mario Carbone. He'd already opened a Carbone at the Aria, another MGM Resorts property, and it's been packed every night, just like his 11 other Carbones in cities like New York, Dallas, Miami, and London. So Bill Hornbuckle, CEO of MGM Resorts, asked if he'd like to take over the iconic space. Carbone agreed while also knowing this location needed to offer something different than Carbone's traditional red sauce, heavy meat-focused menu. Vegas already had one of those, so this time he decided to lean into seafood, a nod to the Bellagio itself, which is a campy interpretation of the Lake Como town. Like a lot of seafood, it's 90% new content, he says, of the menu, which is so under wraps it takes multiple proddings for him to get to reveal some of his dishes. Crudos, whole roasted fish, surf and turf with steaks from Snake River Farms, as well as a spicy lobster fettuccine. This, he predicts, is going to be the thing to order, much like how spicy rigatoni is at regular Carbone. It's the aquatic version of the spicy rigatoni, Carbone tells me. He expects the fettuccine will go toe-to-toe with the rigatoni. As the inventor of the spicy rigatoni, I'm allowed to say it, he adds. He's half-joking. Carbone's spicy rigatoni caused a bajillion, rough estimate, other restaurants to add copycats to their menus, which is likely why they're being so secretive about this one, as there are still a few weeks until its November opening. But back to the boat. It's the brainchild of Carbone, but also Hornbuckle, who took a Riva boat a few summers ago while vacationing on the Amalfi Coast. It was a great time, but also an aha moment. Why didn't they have this in their little Italy of Vegas? So they bought one, a specific one, number 11 of the 18 limited edition Riva Anniversario yachts. In early October, they craned the 33-foot six-person vessel into the lake as tourists filmed on. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program, and we are in the middle of the Hollywood section talking about Carbone's Las Vegas. Both Carbone and Hornbuckle attended its christening ceremony this October, where they broke bottles of Dom Perignon on its hull before taking a maiden voyage around the lake as Sinatra's Fly Me to the Moon played. A number of executives watched on the dock where tables were set with white tablecloths and Riva upholstered chairs. This was a big coup, I learned, as Riva usually only does interiors for private clients. Afterwards, Hornbuckle and I sat in Carbone Riviera. The Renoirs and their gilded frames are the corner of my eye. All of this, the restaurant, the art, the boat, is about romance, he explains. The romance of Bellagio, the romance of the lake, the romance of a great experience. Is he happy with how it turned out? $19 million speaks for itself, he says. Although $19 million may soon feel like a chump change for Carbone, every concept he does seems to be getting bigger and bigger. In the past few years, he's opened a private club in New York City called Carbone Privado that cost $30,000 to join. He's held Miami Grand Prix dinners on the beach that cost $3,000 a head and attract the likes of Jeff Bezos and Ivanka Trump. In 2023, news broke that Carbone's parent company, Major Food Group, was developing condos in Florida City's Edgewater District months after Carbone lost its Michelin star. Carbone remained nonplussed. "I didn't ask for it to begin with, so take it." With 2025 came Vegas and its boat. And on the eventual horizon, "You're going to see Carbone hotels at some point," he says, noting that he's looking for heritage sites in several American cities. "Something that I can hold on to, something that has great texture that we can work off." There's no firm plan in place yet, but he's feeling confident. Confident about it all. Lucky number 13, he tells me, of Carbone Riviera. His 13th official Carbone. Put it on black tonight. We are moving now to the politics section, and our first headline is, from the sandwich trial to Chicago, some courts are fed up with Trump's baloney. This week saw a few major wins in the long-running battle between Donald Trump and reality. This is by Eric Lutz on November 7th. In normal times, it would go without saying that shooting a praying pastor in the head with a pepper ball is worse than throwing a sandwich at some guy. But in abnormal times like these, you have to take the wins where you can. And this week did seem like a win in the long-running battle between Donald Trump and reality. On Thursday, Trump's Justice Department was delivered a legal setback with an extra helping of humiliation when jurors found Sean Dunn not guilty of misdemeanor assault on a federal officer over an August incident in which Dunn chucked a Subway sandwich at a Customs and Border Protection agent in Washington. The 37-year-old former DOJ paralegal had thrown the sub at agent Greg Lairmore as an act of resistance against Trump's crackdown in D.C. The government argued that he crossed a line and interfered with law enforcement operations. The sandwich, Lairmore testified this week, exploded on his chest. "It smelled of onions and mustard," the agent testified. Jurors were unconvinced that constituted assault. The DOJ first got a taste of failure back in August when the Office of U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, a former Fox personality, tried to charge Dunn with a felony but could not persuade a grand jury to approve the federal indictment. "I'm relieved," Dunn said after his acquittal Thursday, "and I'm looking forward to moving on with my life." Later on Thursday, District Judge Sarah Ellis sharply rebuked the federal government over its Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago, challenging the credibility of CPB Commander Greg Bovino and other agents over their trumped-up justifications for an extraordinary use of force in the city. "The feds have engaged in activity in Chicago that shocks the conscience," as Ellis put it Thursday. "There have been violent detentions, including one in which armed agents stormed into a daycare this week." Agents, including Bovino, who oversees the officers working under Operation Midway Blitz, have deployed tear gas in neighborhoods on protesters, sometimes without provocation. In one demonstration outside the Broadview Immigration Processing Center, agents fired on a pastor, David Black, as he was praying, striking him in the head with a non-lethal pepper bullet. The Department of Homeland Security said force was necessary to deal with rioters, gangbangers, and terrorists. On Thursday, though, Ellis said that the notion that Chicago was gripped by violence is simply untrue, adding that the administration's arguments lack credibility. Trump, of course, has rarely let a lack of credibility get in his way before. From business to television and now politics, he's built his career on an ability to bend reality to his liking. But there are limits to how far even he can strain credulity, and he appeared to butt up against them this week. Even the Supreme Court, which opened the door to his anti-transgender passport policy this week, and has usually been a reliable Trump ally in his second term, indicated it may be skeptical of his claim that he has the authority to unilaterally impose tariffs without Congress's approval. On Tuesday, voters appeared to outright reject the rosy picture he's tried to paint of the country and its economy under his leadership. Though Trump still insists that he's bringing back the American dream, prices are coming down very fast, he said this week, and we have the most successful economy in the history of our country. Voters in races across the nation turned out for Democrats, apparently frustrated with rising prices, gloomy economic headwinds, and a historic shutdown. Affordability is a problem, Marjorie Taylor Greene, once one of the president's most ardent allies, acknowledged on CNN Thursday. Not that you'd know from watching Trump, who took a break from planning his garish ballroom to host a Gatsby-themed Halloween party the weekend before Tuesday's elections, a scene that served to underscore how out of touch this administration is with the reality of everyday Americans. Reality bites sometimes. This week, it hit Trump like a 12-inch hoagie to the chest. In other news, Zoran Mamdani wins the NYC mayoral election 2025 in a historic victory. The 34-year-old Democratic Socialist ran a Gen Z-fueled campaign aiming to make the city more affordable and equitable for all. After pulling off an upset in this summer's primary, Mamdani toppled the establishment again on Tuesday. This is by Casey Wickman on November 4th. Zoran Mamdani, the 34-year-old Democratic Socialist who went from near obscurity to a stunning win in the New York City mayoral Democratic primary over former Governor Andrew Cuomo, has done it again. Mamdani was voted in as New York City's new mayor on Tuesday. The win was projected by both the Associated Press and NBC less than an hour after polls in the city closed. Mamdani spoke before a packed victory party shortly after 11 p.m. "Thank you to the next generation of New Yorkers who refuse to accept that the promise of a better future was a relic of the past," Mamdani says. He also acknowledged his opponents, namely Cuomo. "I wish Andrew Cuomo only the best in private life, and let tonight be the final time I utter his name," Mamdani said, and he used his stage to speak directly to the president. "Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I've got four words for you. Turn the volume up," Mamdani said to raucous applause. By Election Day, all eyes were on the race in America's most populous city as an electoral proxy for Donald Trump's second stint in the White House. There was Mamdani, the upstart, a Uganda-born political organizer turned state's assemblyman representing the Astoria neighborhood in Queens since 2021, the anointed Democratic candidate. Republican Curtis Sliwa consistently polled last in the race, though he found a slice of TikTok virality with a subset of Gen Z voters. And then there was Cuomo, soundly defeated in the primary, but keeping himself on the ticket anyway as an independent, receiving a last-minute cash infusion of $1.5 million from former Mayor Mike Bloomberg right before Halloween, days before voters headed to the polls. Incumbent Eric Adams, who has his place in the history books for being the first sitting New York City mayor to be indicted on corruption charges, including wire fraud, bribery, and illegal campaign donations, halted his re-election campaign and dropped out of the race in late September. Adams denied wrongdoing, pleaded not guilty, and the case was later dismissed. Many of his former supporters, a notable segment of whom belonged to an ultra-wealthy tax bracket, shifted their allegiance to Cuomo after Adams' defection, and Adams himself endorsed Cuomo in late October, despite having called him a snake and a liar in September. Adams shrugged off the comment when asked about it after his endorsement. "Brothers fight," he said by way of explanation. Still, Mamdani didn't forget, telling Vanity Fair's James Pogue via text in the days following Adams' withdrawal from the race that he had a message to voters. "I'd say listen to what Eric Adams said. Andrew Cuomo is a liar and a snake." The selfie-taking, meme-friendly Mamdani ran a campaign that captivated not just the city, but the world, and he has now been elected New York City's first Muslim mayor and the youngest to occupy Gracie Mansion in over a century. Hugh John Grant, a two-term mayor, was believed to have been 31 years old at his first inauguration in 1889, keeping his distinction as the youngest ever to win the office. Running on a platform that media coverage often described as relentlessly focused on affordability, Mamdani won the endorsements of celebrities like Emily Ratajkowski and Lorde, popular progressive politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, and people who are a bit of both, like Cynthia Nixon, not to mention the coveted hot girl vote. I think to be a New Yorker is also to be an American, Mamdani told Vanity Fair of his lived experience moving to the city after living his first 7 years in Uganda and returning there every summer, becoming an outsider emigre there while also negotiating life as an outsider immigrant in the United States. To me, the city is the best of what our country has to offer. It's a city where these identities are not necessarily in hierarchy or in contention, but where they're all examples of what it means to belong here. In September, Mamdani responded to those who questioned whether his campaign's idealistic goals would be achievable in office. For as much as this is an immense responsibility, it is also an opportunity and one that deeply excites me, the prospect of delivering on this agenda, he told Vanity Fair. People speak to me as if the campaign was one thing and then governing must be another. My job is to deliver on the promises that I've made. These are not anchors that I view tying my feet down. These are North Stars that I will wake up every morning and head towards. Next up, like Vienna in 1914, at Bob Barnett's memorial, Washington's power class peers over the brink. At a D.C. power broker's memorial, politicos including James Carville, Jesse Waters, and Anthony Fauci gathered to eat focaccia sandwiches, swap memories, and place literal bets on the future of the company. Piers Morgan owes James Carville $1,000. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on November 5th. It's like Vienna in 1914, said James Carville in his unmistakable drawl. It's like the opening of the Guns of August. Barbara Tuchman's classic first account of the first days of World War I opens with the funeral of King Edward VII, which, for all its pomp and circumstance, nine kings arrive, followed by five heirs apparent, 40 more imperial or royal highnesses, several queens, and a scattering of special ambassadors, marks the start of a steep descent into war. Near Carville stood two police officers guarding a metal detector erected outside the expansive basement ballroom of the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C. There, a few hundred of the people who once ran the town gathered on Monday to mourn the passing of one of their own. The memorial was for Robert Barnett, the famed Washington lawyer, power broker, and confidant of presidents who negotiated blockbuster book deals for superstar clients, including the Clintons, the Bushes, and the Obamas. The invitation-only service, held on a sunny November morning and attended by a dizzying collection of Washington's bold-faced names, was a fitting tribute to Barnett, who died in September at the age of 79. Nearly 700 people packed into the ballroom, filling every seat, to hear speeches from his many clients, Bill and Hillary Clinton, Bob Woodward, and James Patterson, to name a few. Barnett was once labeled the kingpin of Washington book deals by the New York Times, but his influence extended far beyond the Capitol. He negotiated contracts for politicians, television stars, writers, royals, and celebrities, but also acted as a trusted counselor to many. Hillary Clinton wrote in her 2003 memoir, for which Barnett secured her an $8 million advance, that he was the first to suggest to her that Bill might have indeed had an affair with Monica Lewinsky. Washington has changed a lot since Barnett made his fame there. Donald Trump twice stormed into office with a pledge to drain the swamp, which manifested not in a departure from grubby D.C. corruption, but certainly a humbling of the establishment insiders who ruled the Capitol for decades. In Trump's Washington, many of the powerful in the room at the Ritz felt more powerless than ever. They loathe what he's done to the East Wing. There's nothing they can do about it. There was CBS News anchor Nora O'Donnell, whose network's parent company paid $16 million to settle a spurious lawsuit from Trump. There was Woodward, whose Washington Post, to hear people in the room tell it, has been vandalized by its billionaire owner in an effort to appease the new regime. After the service, Woodward stood by the stairs. Andrea Mitchell, another client, squeezed his arm and gave him a warm smile as she left. Senator Amy Klobuchar consoled a pair of mourners inquiring about the possibility of a constitutional crisis. Klobuchar was optimistic. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, she offered, has saved the Republican Party from itself before. Barnett, a staunch Democrat, was one of those special Washington creatures who managed to balance clients on both sides of the aisle. Bob embodied a lost Washington where one person could connect every planet of power, said Mike Allen, the co-founder of Axios. Barnett hailed from a more bipartisan era, one in which Republicans and Democrats backslapped at these kind of events after shredding one another on crossfire. Nowadays, the vitriol is more vicious, more sincere. The bases want blood, their intolerance for that kind of swampy bipartisan hobnobbing enough to get a congressman primaried or attacked by the president on Truth Social. More than half a dozen Fox News hosts and executives attended the memorial, including both Steve and Peter Ducey, star host Jesse Waters, and national security correspondent Jennifer Griffin. Karl Rove and Sarah Palin paid their respects as well. After the service, Barnett's loved ones and clients, it's hard to separate the two, shared fond memories of the man and fond memories of the Washington he left behind over platters of fruit and focaccia sandwiches. "This is the old D.C.," said Carville. "The new Washington is the Washington of Cash Patel." Carville was a client, but also a close friend, so when Barnett's daughter Meredith turned 16, he took her on as an intern. Meredith, now 46, works in content development in New York. Carville was honored that Barnett had entrusted her to him. He was also terrified, recalling one incident in which he asked the teenage Meredith to drive him to pick up Hunter S. Thompson, who, upon sliding into the back seat of the car, pulls out a fucking joint that's bigger than my thumb and starts smoking the fucking thing. I said, "Jesus Christ, we're going to get in a wreck, we're going to get arrested, and I'm going to have to call my wife and tell her Bob's 16-year-old daughter is in central lockup, and she couldn't even drive." Nearby, Fox News CEO Suzanne Scott, Birkenbag in tow, it's been a good year, bade farewell to Waters and his wife Emma, a former Fox producer. "Bob became my lawyer as a young reporter, and I've never had another," Waters told me. "He helped get me where I am today, and he was very good at making sure I didn't get into too much trouble. Bob was a Democrat, but he always reached across the aisle with clients. And with me, I was probably the furthest Bob could reach. He was old school, and I'm going to miss him." Are we witnessing the death of the old Washington? People said that Bob's memorial represented old Washington, where people from both parties could argue but could get along. Waters said, "That Washington will never die. Bob's spirit will always live on. Perhaps it can be rekindled in Trump's big, beautiful ballroom one day." As Waters walked toward the exit, he stopped to chat with Dr. Anthony Fauci, whose performance during the COVID pandemic made him a dunk tank villain on Fox News. Just a few years ago, Waters urged an evident audience to ambush the doctor in public and go in for the kill shot, comments that naturally caused some outrage. Fauci said Waters should be fired on the spot, but Fox defended the host as merely having called for the oratorical murder of the doctor, not his literal assassination. At Barnett's memorial, the two laid down their arms. They shook hands and chatted amiably. Fauci slapped Waters on the back as he left and said, "Good to see you. Last week I met Gail King, this week Dr. Fauci. I feel like I'm going to run into Barack Obama at the grocery store," Waters joked. When Mark Leibovich wrote about another quintessentially Washington send-off, that of Tim Russert, in 2008, he observed that services affirmed everyone by their presence as worthy in the pecking order of Washington power. Inside the room at Barnett's memorial, it felt more like a farewell to a Washington that no longer exists than an assembly of the elite insiders who would shape its future. It boasted many of the same guests who attended Russert's memorial, such as David Axelrod, then the chief strategist for the presidential campaign of a young senator from Chicago, and of course Bill and Hillary Clinton, whom Leibovich described as pros at death and sickness. Hillary, who delivered a eulogy for Barnett, is no longer much of an authority in today's Washington. Like everyone else, she's a podcaster now, and not a particularly influential one. Speaking of podcasters, a giddy Oliver North worked the room. "I spotted Carville again. Ever the operator, he told me he's got a $1,000 bet going with Piers Morgan that Democrat Abigail Spanberger will win Tuesday's election for Virginia governor by more than 5 points. If he wins, Morgan will owe him lunch at Scott's, a posh restaurant in London's Mayfair district. Is Carville confident? Cocky, he told me. It's going to be a blowout." "I'm quietly confident," texted Morgan, a man who is rarely quiet. Upstairs in the lobby of the hotel, a group of businessmen in town for a conference bantered about the good old days. Once upon a time, they had worked at the White House themselves, apparently. They wondered what it would be like to go back and just how much things had loosened up. One turned to the subject of gooning, which is very much the zeitgeist these days. "Jerking off in the West Wing would be cool," he mused. In The Guns of August, Tuchman quotes British Viscount and politician Lord Esher, who wrote after the king's funeral, "All the old buoys which have marked the channel of our lives seem to have been swept away." There was a feeling of the old guard being swept away in the basement of the Ritz on Monday, making way for a more extreme, more partisan, more impolite Washington. "It was a beautiful tribute to Bob," Waters said. "You'll never see a room like that again." Our next headline, Sam Bankman-Fried's mom is posting from his Substack. Why? The report shared Tuesday may be part of the convicted fraudster's parental push to secure a presidential pardon. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on November 6th. On Tuesday, as an attorney for Sam Bankman-Fried argued with a judge considering his appeal, an email landed in the inboxes of those who subscribe to the disgraced crypto mogul's Substack. The email was from Bankman-Fried's mother, Barbara Fried, a Stanford law professor. "So there was no confusion," she wrote. "Just to confirm for those who are asking, yes, the post below was written by Barbara Fried." Attached was a 65-page report written by Fried that made an aggressive case in defense of her son, who was charged in 2022 with defrauding customers of his crypto exchange, FTX, out of billions of dollars. The erstwhile billionaire was convicted on 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy and sentenced to 25 years in prison. It was that conviction and subsequent sentence that Bankman-Fried's legal team appealed in federal court this week. Oral arguments took place on Tuesday with one of his lawyers, Alexandra Shapiro, reportedly making the case that his first trial was fundamentally unfair. She put forth an argument similar to the one made by Bankman-Fried's mother, that FTX collapsed as a result of a liquidity crisis, not fraud. Judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, where, in a neat coincidence, Bankman-Fried's mother was once clerked, were reportedly skeptical of his lawyer's arguments. "From my reading of the record, there was very substantial evidence of guilt," one of the judges told Shapiro. The other two judges on the panel reportedly shared in that skepticism. Should Bankman-Fried lose his appeal, which seems likely given the high burden in such cases, there's another well-trodden path out of federal prison, a pardon. President Donald Trump has, in just his first year back in office, proven to be perhaps the most unrestrained pardoner in modern presidential history, with a particular focus on white-collar criminals. Those to whom he has tossed salvation include Silk Road creator Russ Ulbricht, Aussie media fraudster Carlos Watson, and another criminal crypto billionaire, Binance co-founder Changpeng Zhao. So it may not be that far-fetched to think that Bankman-Fried, despite his past life as a Democratic mega-donor, could nab a coveted get-out-of-jail-free card from Trump. He's been making the rounds. Bankman-Fried sat for a jailhouse interview with Tucker Carlson in March, during which he put forth some subtle MAGA signaling. "In 2020, I was center-left, and I gave to Joe Biden's campaign. I was optimistic he would be sort of a solid center-left president," he told Carlson. "I spent the next few years in D.C. a lot. I made dozens of trips there and was really, really shocked by what I saw, not in a good direction, from the administration," he added. "By late 2022, I was giving to Republicans, privately, as much as Democrats." CBS News reported that Bankman-Fried donated more than $40 million in the 2022 election cycle, with the vast majority going to Democrats. He later claimed that he did donate to Republicans, just using dark money so as not to spark controversy. As Bankman-Fried works publicly to cast himself as a liberal apostate, his parents have reportedly mounted a behind-the-scenes efforts to secure a pardon. Fried and her husband, Joseph Bankman, who is also a Stanford law professor, are consulting with Corey Langhofer, an Arizona lawyer who worked for Mr. Trump's 2016 and 2020 presidential campaigns, according to the New York Times. When reached for comment, Fried pointed me to Langhofer for questions concerning the pardoning efforts. What are the chances? A White House official said the administration does not comment on the existence or non-existence of pardons, adding that Trump has final say on such matters. A former Trump official estimated that the chances are low. "I don't see that one happening," they said, "but I guess never say never." Bankman-Fried's best shot at seducing Trump might be in appealing to the president's own irrepressible feeling that he was wronged by the justice system during the 2024 campaign. When Trump pardoned Albright, he wrote on Truth Social, the scum that worked to convict him were some of the same lunatics who were involved in the modern-day weaponization of government against me. In a jailhouse interview with the New York Sun earlier this year, Bankman-Fried alleged that both he and Trump suffered from the politicization of the Biden Department of Justice. The article also pointed out that Judge Lewis Kaplan, who sentenced Bankman-Fried to a quarter-century bid in prison, was the same judge who presided over E. Jean Carroll's successful defamation case against Trump. Trump labeled Kaplan a bully and a Trump-hating judge after that trial, and behaved so belligerently in his courtroom that he nearly got kicked out. "I know President Trump had a lot of frustrations with Judge Kaplan," Bankman-Fried told The Sun. "I certainly did as well." Our last headline today, the double bind of the AI bubble means we're screwed whether the tech succeeds or fails. Either the bubble bursts and wipes out a huge sector of the economy, or AI replaces human workers across industries. This is by Eric Lutz on November 3rd. The stock market is largely being propped up by a promise of AI that is yet to deliver, setting up what could be a disastrous bubble. But the AI land rush isn't merely a risky gamble. Wall Street is staking the health of the markets and that of the broader economy with it, on a bet against the common good. It seems to be a lose-lose situation for those outside Wall Street and Silicon Valley. If the frenzied investment in artificial intelligence is overheated, as even OpenAI's Sam Altman has warned, the markets could be hit hard enough to shake the economy as a whole, making an impact worse than that of the dot-com bust 25 years ago. But if the gamble pays off, it'll mean a boom for technology that could bring about widespread unemployment and social disruption. If this works as fast as VC money seems to be hoping, society seems wholly unprepared for the consequences, as Daniel Barkey, executive director for the Center of Humane Technology, tells Vanity Fair, citing potential mass unemployment and political instability. If the market is over its skis, then what we're likely to see is a race to the bottom of these dark monetization patterns. We were promised curing cancer, but we're getting AI slop. AI has already led to significant layoffs across a number of industries, including at Amazon, which announced it would slash 14,000 white-collar jobs last week. And Americans appear concerned that it's just the beginning, with more than two-thirds of respondents in a recent Reuters-Ipsos poll worrying that swaths of the workforce could be permanently displaced. And that's for good reason. A report released by Senator Bernie Sanders last month, which ironically made use of ChatGPT, estimated that close to 100 million American jobs could be eliminated in 10 years by AI. Other reports have reached similar conclusions. And all while not all the data is quite so pessimistic, purveyors of the technology themselves have warned about looming job losses. Dario Amodei, CEO of AI company Anthropic, cautioned in an interview with Axios earlier this year that the tech could get rid of half of all entry-level white-collar jobs. As he described the scenario, AI could mean cancer is cured, the economy grows at 10% a year, the budget is balanced, and 20% of people don't have jobs. Amodei said they had an obligation to warn of the potential consequences of AI. But other AI leaders have outright framed such workforce reductions as a selling point for their tech. "Stop hiring humans," read a controversial ad from AI startup Artisan. Big tech is spending big on AI data centers, often financing them with unsustainable debt that puts the financial system at risk, Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren, a critic of both Silicon Valley and Wall Street, and the ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, tells Vanity Fair. "At the same time, we know that companies are already using AI to surveil workers' every move and force schedules on them that maximize profits at the expense of their well-being. And the recent layoffs are a warning sign that AI could cause significant job losses. I worry that the Trump administration is asleep at the switch," she adds. "Absent strong financial safeguards and labor practices, it'll be workers, small businesses, and families who will pay the price." This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great week, everybody.